Hi there, folks. This is Al Clemenson.
You're listening to Cat Tales.
Hi, I'm Kat, and you're listening to Cat Tales. Back in the 70s, there was no other gang quite like the aptly named Sensational Alex Harvey Band, with a unique combination of blurred music genres, eye-catching theatrics, and progressive rock riffs. Saab bedazzled viewers of Top of the Pops and the Old Grey Whistle Test alike. At Alex Harvey's side, for hits like The Faith Healer, Midnight Moses and Delilah, guitarist Sal Clemenson menaced mockingly, portraying a half-mime, half-clown character that was more suitable for a horror film than a musical performance. Zach recounts the rise and fall of Saab, his struggles after joining Nazareth, being a session player with Elkie Brooks and Midur, writing a novel, and exclusively shares a track from his forthcoming album with Orphans of the Ash. This is the one with Sal Clemenson. Well, welcome to the show then, Zal. So pleased I'm speaking to you because I adore the Sensational Alex Harvey Band. So I'm thrilled to speak to you. So thank you very much. Shall we start our conversation around the Sensational Alex Harvey Band? Because that's really what broke you into the music industry, didn't it? How did all that come about? I know that you were obviously in a band before that and you were playing around the circuit in Glasgow. But the real breakthrough really was when you met Alex Harvey, wasn't it?
Yeah, we'd been playing in a band called Tear Gas, who had been going for maybe a couple of years before we met Alex. And we'd had a reasonable amount of sort of success. We transitioned from playing in school bands when we first sort of started to play. When I started to play, we had a band at school and we used to do school dance and used to play church halls and all that in city, town hall. And things all throughout Scotland. But anyway, you know, eventually that, around about 68, 69, was when Tear Gas was sort of put together. And we moved over from what was, at that time, playing dance music effectively into playing what would be described more as heavy rock, prog rock, whatever you want to call it. And so at that time, there was a real transition. We were listening to, you know, a lot of the bands that we really liked, a lot of the musicians and guitar players that had an influence on us, you know, like Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple, bands like that. So Tear Gas kind of got developed into a sort of four-piece that became, and we made a couple of albums, which were okay, not really a lot of financial success. But I think what happened was that our manager at the time, and Alex's manager at the time, they kind of, you know, loosely arrangement, they knew each other, you know, and I think they were both of the opinion that Alex was looking for a band and Tear Gas were kind of looking for a singer or a front man. So that was really how it came about. We got a chance to meet Alex in Glasgow. He came up from London with his guitar and we met him in a pub in Glasgow. We had a little chat. They'd booked a rehearsal room for us nearby and we went into the rehearsal room, we plugged in, and he turned to everybody and says, okay, can you play this riff? And it was the riff from Midnight Moses, one of the songs from the Friends album. And he says, can you play that riff? And of course, we just all looked at each other and instantly sort of beat the living daylights out of it. And he just turned around and with a big smile on his face. I can remember it now. He just turned, bouncing up and down with his guitar. And he had a big smile on his face. And I could just see he was going, yeah, that'll do. And that was pretty much off, you know.
That's amazing, isn't it? Do you know, when it all just gels together, I guess that's what you're looking for, isn't it?
Yeah, I think Alex knew exactly what he was after, you know, because we'd actually played a gig with him. He had another band prior to this, just previous to before we met him, to a band called Giant Moth, and the management company had arranged this gig at the Marquee in London where we support him or he supported us. I can't remember which, but I think there was an opportunity for us to kind of size each other up. I think that's what it was for, to just check each other out and see what was what. And when I heard Giant Moth, I thought, this is dreadful. I mean, it was just awful, musically, the musicianship and so on. But Alex, I could see that there was something there. There was something about him, very focused, very powerful on stage as a performer. You know, he had a great presence. And so I knew there was something there. And so when they decided to say, well, you know, do you want this guy to sing with you? We went, yeah, let's see how it goes, you know, let's see how it goes. And of course, he was a generation ahead of us. He was, you know, he was a good generation, in age, he was a generation ahead. So he was very experienced, very, very, very well disciplined at that time. And yeah, I think it was exactly what we both needed.
Well, it certainly was an absolute recipe for success, wasn't it? I mean, the thing that strikes me most about the Alex Harvey Band, obviously you've got the sensational stuff, you've got the theatre and everything, but the sheer ingenuity, I think, of the music and every song being slightly different in its approach. You had the fun stuff, didn't you? You had the rock stuff, and it was like a synergy of all sorts of, a mixing pot, really, of all different sorts of sounds. Do you think that was the secret of the success, or do you think actually in later times it kind of hindered you?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's a question that's quite dear to my heart, as it were. You've hit the nail on the head, because initially when we did Framed, I thought, yeah, this is cool. This is fairly, it was, you know, a little step. It wasn't that far removed from what Tear Gas were all about, playing basic rock songs, rock riffs, you know, with a kind of a guitar-based approach, and it was quite heavy duty in that sense. But as the band progressed, as the band moved on, what happened was, record company, management company was screaming out for a hit single. You had to have a hit single at that time, yeah. Even though it sounds, you know, to me it just felt ludicrous, so we were chasing this concept of we must have a hit single. So we eventually recorded Delilah, which for me is just a piece of nonsense. I just can't be arsed with it. But it was a hit, you know, and that was that. So from then on, it's like, okay, let's keep on making hit singles. And the problem for me was, and the problem that was implied in your question, is that for me, the competition wasn't Sweet or Mud or, heaven forbid, Gary Glitter. The competition for me was Led Zeppelin, yeah, and Deep Purple and Floyd. That's the kind of band I wanted to be in. So you're right, there was a real kind of watering down, perhaps, of that intention, that original intention for me. But of course, you're caught up in the whole kind of progression of the band and the success that the band was having, to really have to stop and think and say, well, you know, I think we're indulging ourselves a bit too much here, guys. I think we've been a bit too crazy and doing stuff that's a bit too off the wall. And for me, it limited the audience appeal that we had in terms of a straight rock band audience, like an AC/DC or a Guns N' Roses or something like that. You know, I think real rock fans would kind of looked at the album and went, a bit odd, a bit strange, and I don't understand why you're doing Giddy Up a Ding Dong and then playing Faith Healer in the same set. But of course, that's the band. That's what people, as you say, that's what people either loved or hated about the band.
Yeah, absolutely. But I can see exactly what you're saying there, that it could have potentially put up barriers, really, from a commercial point of view. I mean, from an audience point of view, yes, it could be a bit Marmite, you either love it or hate it. But to really progress at that time in the industry, you really had to conform in a sort of way, even though it didn't appear it. You know, even like bands like Queen and Yes, even though they were doing stuff that was not necessarily mainstream, they had to conform, didn't they, to what their audience would probably expect?
Yeah, kind of. It was, well, you know, you'd have to say, well, were Led Zeppelin successful? Really successful without having to prance about on Top of the Pops. And that was that's my whole point, that, you know, that we should have been doing it another way. But anyway, that's how the thing kind of panned out. And you know, nobody complained, because the band was quite meteoric, the rise of the band, you know, especially from a live, because the live situation was very powerful, and it was very visual, and it was very focused, and Alex had a wonderful way of just, you know, almost intimidating an audience, you know, either like us or don't like us, but, you know, you're going to get this, and that was the kind of thing that we had.
Amazing. Yes, absolutely. So looking back on those times, it sounds like you do have very fond memories of, you know, of what you were and where your origins lie, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it was a great band to be in. It was a great bunch of musicians, very good musicians, you know, good level of musicianship. And that exactly was what Alex needed. He knew, right? Because, you know, we were aware of Alex before we met him, that he had a band called the Big Soul Band, which had brass and stuff, and it was very kind of in that R&B soul, sort of mold, sort of James Brown kind of stuff, which is kind of the music that I was brought up listening to. So we knew of him, and we knew that he was, you know, professional, very consummate sort of professional, and that's how it kicked off with Alex. You know, he was very focused, very professional. He knew exactly what he wanted to hear and see. He directed the band in such a way that, as you said earlier, the theatrics began to become quite prominent part of what the band was doing. There's another live gig. So it was slick. It was almost choreographed to an extent.
Mm.
And of course, that comes across, you know, when people see a show like that, they really get involved in it. You know, they get caught up in it.
Yeah, absolutely. Very professional, isn't it? Whatever, you know, you say about it, that whole sort of slickness, as you say, was very powerful. I mean, you mentioned there earlier that Delilah wasn't really your favourite track. Which one would you choose, to say, looking back at that era, that I'm very proud of that particular one. Is there one that you can choose?
There's a handful of Sab songs that appeal to me. One would be St. Anthony from the Framed album, which is very much like almost like a tear gas song. That's a great tune. Faith Healer is a classic that everybody loves when it's done live. The recorded version is a bit daft, but the live version is excellent. There's a couple of others like Compliments to the Chef, which is quite a powerful tune. Man in the Jar, which is like a jazz fusion kind of thing, which is a really, really interesting piece of music. But my favourite track from Sab is from the Rock Drill album. It's a song called Dolphins, which is part of the Rock Drill suite. And it's just musically, it just has an appeal for me that just has such a great, great groove, great rip. And it's a great song to play.
We'll be right back. could take the wild and the weak. He could take your brain and hang it on the end of an iron chain. The master showed his slave that a man ain't nothing but a man. But before I'm gonna let that bomb bill beat me down, I'm gonna die with that hammer in the hand. That hammer in the hand.
Hi there, folks. This is Al Clemenson. I'm just enjoying a really nice interview with Cat Tales.
What I was going to ask you was about the band being such an influence on everybody else in the music industry at that time. Everybody, that's probably a little bit wide, isn't it? But certain bands have actually said and cited you as being a great influence. The Cult, for example, the Dead Daisies, as they are now. Has that surprised you?
Yeah, it did actually. It has the sort of longevity, I suppose, and how the influence has prevailed over the years. It's I do recall at the time when the band was kind of folding up, and Alex was very unhealthy. His health wasn't good. His marriage wasn't good. Same for some of the other guys in the band. It was just one of those rock and roll stories where things begin to disintegrate a little bit. And that's when we were recording Rock Grill at that time. And I remember the punk thing just kicking off. And Alex was really, well, we were all quite fascinated by it, but for different reasons, I guess. Alex was really, really interested in what they were saying and what this very almost basic kind of approach to playing guitars and chords and songs, the aggression, the kind of message that was there. He felt there was something going on. Whereas initially the rest of the band, and I include myself a little bit in it, we had a bit of musical snobbery involved, because we thought, because we were all such good technical musicians, when you listen to punk bands, you think, oh, these guys can't play it.
Yeah.
You know, play properly. That's just three chords, blah, blah, blah. And you get that kind of, oh, I don't know if I like this or not. But it didn't take long for me to suddenly realise that, yeah, there's something going on here, Sex Pistols. Obviously, we're big fans of Sab, because Alex went down to the Vortex Club in down in London, maybe Wardour Street somewhere, the Vortex, where some of these bands were playing, and he wanted to immerse himself in this, what was happening, and he wanted to think, pick up on it, and I think he wanted to use that as a catalyst to take things maybe a step further. But as I say, by that time the band had kind of lost its edge, lost its direction a bit, and so it we never quite took on board what Alex, I think, was hoping to do.
It's interesting, isn't it, that you mentioned punk, because when I would look back on punk and think exactly the same at the time, it seemed like it was just a complete musical dross, didn't it? But when you hear back to some of those artists, you know, the Sex Pistols being a case in point there, you think actually it was a lot more skillful in terms of its creativity than you gave it credit for at the time, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a rebellion, you know, it was a rebellion against prog rock and the technique of you know, musicianship, where your technique, you know, the famous expression of disappearing up your own arse, you know, that sort of thing, where musicians just tend to gazing at their own navel and just making things more involved and more complicated simply for the sake of it, you know, to make themselves look clever. And I think that's where music was heading. And I think the punk movement just went, no, I don't like that at all. I don't even like the way it looks. I don't like the way it sounds. I don't like what you're playing. And you're right, Sex Pistols, Clash, Stranglers, all those sort of bands that just sort of came out of that. You know, they just took songwriting to another level, to another place. You know, okay, it's not, you know, as I say, you know, you could look at punk music and then go back to Eddie Cochran or Buddy Holly. You could go back and take it back to that sort of level, where it's very basic, very simple chords, but there was a noise about punk, there was an attitude, and there was something going on there that definitely, well, you know, had the effect that it had.
Yeah, and you can see why, can't you? I can also see where that would have been a great progression for the band at the time, and I'm not surprised to hear that Alex was down there investigating that, because there were elements of punk, really, as part of the whole setup of SAP all the way through, really, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think that was more to do with Alex and his attitude and his approach to, you know, the lyrics. His lyrics are just incredible. His delivery is very unique. You know, the voice, he's singing with a Scottish accent most of the time, which was something quite off the wall. Mm. It was never appealed to me initially, but I can understand why it had the appeal that it had. There's a kind of an aggression in his voice. There's a kind of an aggression in his accent. Which you know, and of course the subject matter was touching on things like, you know, his great message on stage was to tell the people, you know, don't piss in the water supply and all that sort of stuff. He was into the ecology, he was into the whole green movement, he was into the pacifist movement, don't buy any bullets, don't make bullets, don't shoot bullets. You know, all these messages that Alex had, they were like a precursor to what we're talking about today.
Yeah.
So that had a big, big appeal, I think, for the audience, for a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can see why people still look back on it even now. So moving on from that then, let's have a look at everything else, Al, because that's only one part of your career, isn't it? And so after that, you found yourself, I guess, in a little bit of a desert, didn't you? Because, of course, the band disbanded, as you say. Where did you think in terms of your head, where shall I go to next? Or at the time, you just thinking, do you know what, I just can't face doing this again?
Well, what happened was the band, when we were rehearsing it, at Shepperton Studios, the big movie soundstage studios down at Shepperton, where you could set up your entire backdrop and the whole, you know, the whole sort of production, just prior to going out and doing a European tour, headlining our own European tour, which would have been a real step for the band. That would be a real, you know, so we were just beginning to start that rehearsal schedule when Alex came in one day, sat down on the stage and said, I can't do this anymore. And his health wasn't good. He'd been drinking heavily. You know, the touring and everything, the whole schedule of SAB was completely hectic, haywire.
Yeah.
And it just, oh. So when he said that, he says, look, I can't do this anymore. He jumped in a taxi and just shot off back home. So we sat there and went, okay, guys, you know, that's the tour. So the tour's cancelled. And I went back home and I just thought to myself, look, what am I going to, how can I make 200 quid a week? That's what we were getting paid at the time as a band members. No royalties, I have to add, just 200 quid a week, which was okay at that time. It was mid-70s, late-70s. And I said to myself, right, I'm going to have to go out and find a job here to pay these bills. And I took my cab down to the local mini cab company, up in East Finchley, North London Hire. Got a radio stuck in my car and I drove a mini cab around London for about a year or two, off and on, just to pay the bills, sort of thing. So,
yeah.
And that's when during that time, I got a call from, well, when Saab actually, I've jumped the gun a little bit. When Saab actually did break up, there was an abortive attempt to keep the ball rolling from the management company and the record company. So they kind of, they looked at an option, which was to find the next name that they could put out there. And so they called something Zal Band, which was, you know,
yeah,
as I say, a bit ill-conceived. The whole thing didn't really happen, didn't really work. So as I say, I ended up driving the minicab around London, basically.
Well, do you know that it's amazing to, you know, to think that at the end of the day, you know, you have to go out and you have to earn money. And it's great that you took that step to just say, well, do you know, OK, that's where I was. But, you know, practically, I need to go out and earn money. And it's so refreshing to hear that, because a lot of people would possibly go, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to just jump straight back into something. And it doesn't matter what kind of band it is. And you could see how you could easily get into rack and ruin because of it.
Yeah, there was no guarantee, you know, there was no guarantee that anything musical. Saab, yeah, had got to a certain level, but financially it was a disaster.
Yeah.
You know, it was, as I say, we were on £200 a week as a retainer, let's call it. But, you know, when we spoke to our management company, we said, look, well, you can do two things. You can either have a cut of the share of the royalties when they come in, or you can have £200 a week constant, you know, as a payment. And everybody decided just to take the £200 a week. So there was never any royalties paid to any of the members of the band. Mm. No published royalties. But anyway, that's a different story. That's another one of those rock and roll, you know.
Oh, it is, isn't it? So many people have got the same story, haven't they? That they, you know, how they were influenced or made the wrong decisions at the time. And, oh dear, it's a sad state of the industry at the time, I think, isn't it?
Well, yeah. The management company eventually went into liquidation, you know, because of the complete mismanagement of the whole situation in terms of advances that came from Phonogram, from record companies that were paying advances for our recordings to be made, but the advances were being used for other bands, for other projects. The whole thing was cross-collateralized, and it was a complete disaster. So that's why the company folded up.
Yeah.
And you know, when the management company eventually went into liquidation, the four members of the band, not Alex, but the four members of the band received a letter from their lawyers to say that each of us owed the company £70,000.
Oh my
each.
God! Oh no!
And hang on a minute, where did that figure come from, you know?
Yes.
And I often think to myself, here's a band that headlined the Reading Festival, and yet at the end of the day they turn around and say, no, you still owe us £70,000, you know, £70,000 each.
God, I can't imagine the horror at the time, because, I mean, you know, you're talking the 70s as well. It was just like, oh my God.
Well, it's demoralising, isn't it? You know,
absolutely.
If you're trying to continue playing, trying to continue to be a musician and create and write stuff and all that, and you've got that hanging over your head, you think, what the hell am I doing in this business? You know. Hi there, folks. This is Al Clemenson. Enjoying a really nice interview with Cat Tales.
Yeah. It must have felt that, actually, do you know what, I don't want to do this again. But you carried on, didn't you, in the industry? Because, of course, you then joined Nazareth. You know, we have to talk about Nazareth, another legendary Scottish band, of course. So, you know, you're there in the taxi at the moment in your life. How did it move from that to going to join Nazareth?
Well, we knew Nazareth. They were part of the same management company, although they actually owned the company, as it turns out. So they were the ones responsible for the kind of, I don't know, well, how things were invested and so on. But when our manager was killed in an air crash, who managed the whole company, he was managing Nazareth and Sab. And he was a mentor for Alex. He was a good old friend of Alex's. They went back a long way. And when he was killed in a plane crash, I think it took its toll on Alex, and I think that was the start of the downfall, as it were. But so we knew Nazareth, and we'd worked with Dan on his solo album. Sab had played the whole, recorded with him the whole album, with Dan's solo album. And so we'd worked in the studio. We all knew each other. And then I got a phone call from Manny Charlton, the guitar player. They were over in Isle of Man for tax reasons, and I had. With a mobile recording studio, and he says, "Look, do you want to come over? We're just starting an album. It's called No Mean City. We could do with some songwriting." I think they were really more interested in having another songwriter with some fresh ideas and a fresh approach. So I said, "Yeah, I'll come over." And we knocked a few things around, played some guitar, recorded a couple of songs that I had, and it sounded okay. It sounded fairly good, you know. And then we went on from there to do the Malice in Wonderland album, which I wrote a lot of songs for, again, recorded in the Bahamas, I suppose, for tax reasons. Mm-hmm. So it's in the,
there's a story the here, planet. Isn't there?
Yeah, there's something going on, yeah.
Yeah, a bit of a pattern.
Mm.
So did you enjoy the time with Nazareth then, when you actually did do the work aspect of it, the writing of the music, the recording part of it, the bit that's close to your soul? Did that feel good at the time, or did it just, you know, was it a second sort of, yeah, playing second fiddle to Sab?
Well, initially, yeah, because we were all pals, and it's kind of heavy rock music. A lot of the stuff is quite nice to play from a guitarist's point of view. Some decent riffs and things, and, you know, a bit of guitar work and so on. And of course, when I got flown out to America to see how they were doing, and of course they were headlining big stadiums and things like that, and I thought, wow, you know, this is, you know, with Love Hurts have been a very, very big hit out in the States. So they were doing big business in America and Canada, Japan, not so much in Europe, but yeah, a bit in Europe, not so much in Britain actually. But so yeah, I mean, I just thought, okay, you know, I'll join in, I'll get involved. And then, as I say, it lasted a couple of years. We got through the Malice in Wonderland album, and I was still on my 200 quid a week. And I thought, yeah, I'm writing all these songs. I wonder what's happening with the publishing royalties next. Because here we go, we're back to the same story again.
Yeah.
And we were scheduled to do another album. This was after Malice had come out. So I was up in Dunfermline, where the guys lived, in Scotland, in Fife. And they were saying, right, okay, we want to get some more songs done now. And I'm saying, yeah, you mean you want me to write more songs while you guys sit in the pub? And it was more or less, the answer was more or less, yeah, yeah, you know. Yeah. And I thought, nah, I can't be asked for this anymore, you know. And I was wanting to take my music somewhere else, basically. I wanted it to be a bit more involved, a bit more jazz, and a bit more fusion. I wanted the guitar to be more kind of off the wall and crazy, and more of my big heroes is Frank Zappa, and I was wanting to get more involved in that side of that type of music, if you like. And the guys would just look at me, I'd come up with a riff, and they'd go, no, that's just crazy, you know. And I think, yeah, okay, I'm in the wrong place now.
Yeah.
And that's when I just said to them, okay, I'll go my way, and good luck, guys, you know.
So is that how you've really come about doing your own stuff predominantly now, haven't you? Because, of course, you've had Sin Dogs, and now you've got your latest collaboration with Orphans of the Ash Music. But that's essentially you, isn't it? It's your heart in there, your music, your direction. Does that feel a lot more free?
Yes, it does, yeah. I mean, you've got a slight more degree of control over it, even though with Sin Dogs it got a little bit watered down. It was a project that was very, very, very important to me, Spin Dogs because of my ill health at the time, and I had to find a way of getting myself. I hadn't played the guitar for about 10 years, and I haven't even touched it. Didn't go near it. And at the time, my marriage was breaking down, and I met another young lady from Yorkshire, and we got together, and her job took us out to Cyprus for about 3 or 4 years. And during that time in Cyprus, I had a serious mental breakdown due to depression and anxiety and so on. It was a complete disaster. Mm. And and I just thought, well, hang on a minute, I need to do something. And then I said, well, let's see what happens. So I had a little guitar out there with me, an acoustic guitar. And I said, I'll pick up the guitar and see what happens. And lo and behold, I started to get ideas, songs came, riffs came. And it kind of progressed from there. And it was like a form of therapy more than anything to get myself through this. And as I say, cut a long story short, it progressed into the Sin Dogs band. So it worked well for me. It got me back to doing what I do best, in a sense. But it was a little bit... The songs were great. Music was great, but the production let it down. For me, again, it was taking a little bit out of my control. Not that I have much control when it comes to producing anything, but it didn't quite work production-wise. But it was good. It was energetic. It was exciting. A lot of people enjoyed it, and it got me to another place that I needed to be,
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And what you're describing there with music being the healer in a way, isn't it? When people in circumstances that you've described, just listening to music, find it healing. So I can totally appreciate that you're in that dark, dark space and you think, I'm going to go back to my roots and really pick up that guitar again and play it, because, you hadn't played it for such a long time, had you? So that must have felt uplifting just to be able to go, I feel like I've come home.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. 100%. I mean, it's back to what you do best, And when you're a musician, any kind of creative end, you're what's in the creative arts in any sphere, I think there's always a problem of up and downs, highs and lows. It's the good times and the bad times and the creative times and the shit times when you can't think of anything. So, yeah, it's a process, and it's a mental process, and it's something you have to get control of. But as things progress from Sin Dogs now into Orphans of the Ash, I have much more control. When Sin Dogs broke up, it was Willie, the guitar player, Billy McGonigal, and myself decided that we wanted to go in a different direction. We wanted to be more guitar based again, more. I don't know, just a slightly different approach, more grunge, more metal, etc. So we've kind of pulled our resources, Billy and myself, and just called ourselves Orphans of the Ash. And working on songs right now. I've got 3 or 4 songs recorded, ready for the album, which will be due out sometime next spring, I would have thought, early spring. We'll be right back. Hi there, folks. This is Al Clemenson. Enjoying a really nice interview with Cat Tales.
How exciting. And people have already started to buy your merchandise, haven't they? Which is amazing. They're all there getting their collection of Sal stuff.
Yeah, I felt a little, I don't know what the word for it is, I felt a little bit of a cheat, actually, you know, saying, well, there's no music out yet, but do you want to buy a T-shirt? You know, it's kind of like...
That's what it's all about, isn't it? It's, you know, people are there to support you. You know, you have got your loyal fans, you know, and they're there. That's great.
Yeah, I know. I thank them every time I go onto Facebook because they're absolutely devoted. And many, many of the fans go all the way back to Saab. And there's obviously a cohort that have seen everything, seen my whole career, and they've followed it. And I'm so appreciative. I can't believe how much these people have stuck with me over the years through all sorts of stuff. And as I say, when Sin Dogs came out, there was it was almost like a great sort of universal sigh of relief to say, oh, great, you're playing music again. How wonderful. So I'm determined not to lose that connection and determined not to lose that momentum, as it were, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure you now, you know, the fact that you're writing the album, you're producing the album, and you're going to have so much more of yourself in there. And I think that word control is really important in the music industry particularly, isn't it? Where most of the time, you can feel out of control. And when you're a creative, you know, you need a little bit of control, don't you, over your creations?
Yeah. I mean, it's a thing that's easily lost, you know, because there's a point where you have to collaborate with other people, you know. But I think the lesson I've learned is the smaller you can keep that group, that collaborative group, the smaller you can keep it, the better chance you have of keeping control. And it's a bit like working with people who are like-minded, I suppose, yeah. People who are on the same wavelength as you. And that's often the problem with bands and the breakup of bands, is because you end up people with just that classic difference of opinion, that musical direction, blah, 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 all those excuses that people make for bands falling apart. It's and egos, of course, come into it. A lot of ego. It plays a big part, you know.
Yeah, that's the downfall of quite a lot, isn't it, really? But so as well as music, from the creative point of view, I understand that you're doing some writing, some actual being an author of a book, or you're doing some sort of writing there. Is that another outlet for you from a creative point of view, or how did that come about?
Yeah, I mean, I've always felt from a long way back, I started to write narratives, you know, prose, with an idea that I knew that, you know, I just wanted to write a book. I just knew it. It was something I just wanted to do, and it's taken me an awful long time to get it to a stage where I'm on a final draft of the book now. It's a novel set in the future, which is more to do with evolution, species evolving, etc., etc. And it's quite kind of fictional in that sense. But yeah, it's again, it's therapeutic, but it's also a discipline that I find, you know, I find quite hard to sort of really. Even though the book's more or less complete and is on a final draft, as I say, there's still so much of it you have to get right before you can say this is suitable for the public to read. You know, it's that kind of that stage.
Yeah, I can understand that. And of course, you've mentioned a great word there of discipline. It gives you that discipline where you have to actually, you know, put a certain number of hours aside to produce the work, doesn't it? That's the sort of like juxtaposition of a creative mind, isn't it, in a way?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I have the two sides now, you know, the music and the novel are the two things that occupy my time 100% of the time. So... yeah, I drift between one and the other, but I can't really do them both side by side. It's either one thing or the other with me. I can't really concentrate on both at the same time.
Yeah, I can understand that, actually. It's sort of, you know, you've got to put all your energy into one thing to produce it well, haven't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that. Now, that discipline part of it is really interesting because you've also done some session work, haven't you, when you've when you retired, shall we say, the first time from the music industry.
Yeah.
Did that help with that sort of like discipline in the music, you know, the production of music? Because when you're in a band, it's almost a little bit free flow, isn't it? Jazz, you know, uses that all the time. And you've said that you quite enjoy that part of it. So being in a session, you know, being in a session musician, you have to kind of do and deliver what somebody else wants, don't you?
Yeah, no, yeah, absolutely. You're dead right. It was, and the first foray I had into that was with Elkie Brooks, when I was living down in England, down in Henley, and I had worked on a little project called Tandoori Cassette with Barry Barlow, the drummer from Jethro Tull. Never quite got anywhere. It was excellent music, really interesting, but just, you know, never saw the light of day, to be honest. But I got a phone call from John Giblin, Elkie's bass player, who says we're looking for a guy. Jeff Whitehorn, her guitarist, was about to leave, and she was looking for a guitar player, and he says, come down, have an audition. I went down to the audition. I'd listened to a couple of her tunes before I went there, and managed to learn a couple of tunes before I got there, and she was... So I got the gig with Elkie, and it's exactly as you said. It was having to play something that, for me, I'd never really had to play before. Types of songs, type of arrangements, the strict discipline of, you know, playing a part. I mean, my guitar playing is pretty much off the wall. I play more or less pretty free form most of the time, certainly with Sab, and you know, when I play solos, it's just the first thing that comes into my head. So the discipline of learning parts with Elkie was something. Same with Bonnie Tyler, when I played a couple of, spent a year or two with Bonnie Tyler. And then eventually I got the call from Mid-Year to, he'd been rehearsing to go on world tour with the Gift album that he'd recorded. And he had Nick Ronson had come in to play guitar, but it didn't seem to be working out. And I don't think Nick was, I don't know, I never met him, but I don't know if he was very healthy at the time. But for whatever reason, it wasn't working out. And again, I got a call to say, can you come down? It was about 2 weeks before they were going on tour. And Mitch says, can you step in? I says, yeah, I'll come down. And that was wonderful. It was nice. Mitch's music is really good. He's a great guitar player himself. And it's a different kind of music, but it's the kind of music that I can like it. It's nice. It's got something about it. And I really enjoyed that tour with Mitch.
Excellent. I can understand that too, because I've met Midge and he's a lovely guy, isn't he? Always nice to work with people that you like as well, isn't it?
Well, I'd never met him before, and the first time we met, we felt like we were blood brothers, you know. We just looked at each other and went, oh yeah, I know who you are. And he said, yeah, I know who you are. And it was like, you know, he's from Glasgow, he's from down the road from where I'm. So we were like, as I say, there's a brotherly sort of instinct there, you know.
Brilliant. So come on then, Sal, what have you got left in your life that you want to fulfil? You've got your new album coming out in the new year, hopefully springtime. We've talked about that, and we've talked about your lovely novel. When's that going to hopefully make the light of day?
Well, in an ideal world, they would both appear next year. Certainly the music will be out, the album will be done. We've got about four tracks, as I said earlier, we've got four tracks which are pretty much complete, just need to be mastered and so on. So, and we've got a whole queue of songs just waiting to be done. You know, there's no shortage of ideas. There's no shortage of songs. So, yeah, we'll have 7, 8, whatever many songs you can get on an album these days. And that will certainly be out, I would have thought, in the springtime on a CD and on a vinyl. A lot of people talking about vinyl and the things like that, even though it's quite expensive to produce. But
yeah,
it's an attractive option for people. So, yeah, so the music, the Orphans music will continue. As I say, no shortage of songs and ideas. So that music will go on and on and on. The book might just be a little more circumspect in terms of getting that finished for next year. I would love to have it out next year. I have a publisher, an editor who's working on it with me. So it would be nice to see both come to some sort of fruition next year.
Oh, how exciting. And is there anything else on the horizon for you?
On the horizon, I'm going to be going to the shops in a minute.
Yes, exactly.
I'm off to Lidl in about half an hour. stock up on a couple of things. Get myself a bottle of red wine.
Oh, lovely.
And maybe have a Chinese takeaway later. And that's about as far as my mind has stretched.
It's a bit like mine, Sal. Oh, do you know what? It's been absolutely wonderful speaking to you.
Fantastic. Okay, Super. Darling, great.
Thank you. Have a lovely day and enjoy that glass of wine.
Good luck with everything. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Speak soon. Thank you for listening to Cat Tales with me, Cat, and my guest today, Zal Clemmensen. The tracks featured are The Faith Healer and The Dolphins by Saab, Hearts Grown Cold by Nazareth, and The Last Train Home by Orphans of the Ash, which are available in stores and digitally on all main streaming and download outlets. To listen to this again and to other tales, visit cattales.co.uk.
You've been listening to Cat Tales.